This podcast episode is brought to you by Weaver House because we have a few exciting updates to talk about. We've gently reopened our Philadelphia store for in-person shopping, and although we have limited hours, now y'all can once again shop all our yarns with your own eyeballs, which is a huge upgrade for project planning. We've also brought back weaving workshops starting this fall. You can learn more about our reopening at weaverhouseco.com/visit-us and more about our workshops at weaverhouseco.com/workshop-registration. You can also sign up for our mailing list on our website to stay up to date on shop happenings and new products and workshops.
Welcome to the Material Culture Podcast, where we're exploring narratives of weaving, history, manufacturing, and the people who make it all possible. When people used to spin yarn or weave cloth, there were no such thing as podcasts, and instead they would sit and share stories. I hope that this can be a place for you to do just that as we explore what it means to create. I'm your host, Rachel T. Snack, not to be confused with Rachel E. Snack, who runs Weaver House, the parent company of this podcast. I'm not really a weaver, but I'm fascinated by what it could look like to create while dreaming of a better world, and what it could look like if we took the time to listen to each other's stories. This month, we're launching a new season of Material Culture, which is taking more time and effort to produce, but that we're hoping will bring us together as a weaving community with intention around the way that we dive into our shared practices and their history and meaning. This episode, we really explore what it could look like to be in relationship to our materials, the people that make them, and our fellow creators as we share in our gifts and our resources. Joining me this episode is Rachel E. Snack, who I mentioned earlier. And in the spirit of community, we've also asked for voice memos from our community members, which are featured throughout the episode. We're all more connected than we think. Join us as we find our common thread. Hi, this is your host, Rachel T. Snack, and I'm here with Rachel E. Snack. If you haven't been with us before, Rachel E. is the founder and director of Weaver House, the parent company of this podcast. She's also my sister-in-law, which is why we have the same name. So hi, Rachel. It's great to be with you today.
Hi, Rachel. It's great to be back in conversation with you. If y'all hadn't noticed, we took some time off from producing episodes as Rachel and I took a much needed moment of rest. We reflected and brainstormed and ultimately decided to steer the ship in a different direction, so to speak. We're launching a new series of Material Culture. And so to start, I wanted to ask Rachel, how do you feel about the episodes we've released so far? And what are you most excited for in terms of the future of the podcast?
Yeah, so I've loved recording the episodes we've done so far. I've loved each of our guests and all of the perspectives that they've brought. But something that I am excited about in the future is to kind of build on what we talk about each episode so that, like, for the listeners, they're getting more of a cohesive experience and we're not like going over the same topics again and again, but also just getting back to kind of like our initial mission. When we were thinking about this podcast, we had done some research and listened to other weaving podcasts, and there's a lot of ones that are artist interview based and they're awesome. But we were kind of going for something different in telling a story about justice and equity in the fiber arts world and answering some big questions and kind of just getting back to people at all different stages of fiber arts creation, whether that's manufacturing, whether that's just in getting the materials themselves, and just being able to have a more cohesive journey as we talk through different topics and take a deep dive into certain questions.
Right, because it's so important to highlight these artists and to give people, you know, a platform and a voice. And I feel like every episode I've listened to where you've interviewed different weavers and artists, it's been really interesting and very insightful to like hear about, you know, you in discussion about these different things. But there is sort of this idea that we've been talking about carrying on like a longer conversation, like, you know, involving multiple voices, involving the community, looking at what we want to do more holistically. So we decided to name this new series On Being after I shared an excerpt with Rachel from Annie Albers' book On Weaving. And for those of you who don't know who Annie Albers is, I highly suggest giving her a Google because she's one of the most influential modern day weavers. She learned to weave when she was studying at the Bauhaus in Germany, which is also where she met her husband, painter Joseph Albers, and then moved to the US and started teaching at Black Mountain College after the Bauhaus was forced to close due to Nazi pressure. She's an incredibly influential weaver, artist, designer, and she's written beautifully about the craft of weaving. On Weaving is a really special piece of text for me. And so I wanted to read a specific passage called Tactile Sensibility, which is part of chapter 8 in Annie Albers' On Weaving. All progress, so it seems, is coupled to regression elsewhere. We have advanced in general, for instance, in regard to verbal articulation. The reading and writing public of today is enormous. But we certainly have grown increasingly insensitive in our perception by touch, the tactile sense. No wonder a faculty that is so largely unemployed in our daily plodding and bustling is degenerating. Our materials come to us already ground and chipped and crushed and powdered and mixed and sliced, so that only the finale in a long sequence of operations from matter to product is left to us. We merely toast the bread. No need to get our hands into the dough. No need, alas, also little chance to handle materials, to test their consistency, their density, their likeness, their smoothness. No need for us either to make our implements, to shape our pots or fashion our knives. Unless we are specialized producers, our contact with materials is rarely more than a contact with the finished product. We remove a cellophane wrapping and there it is. The bacon or the razor blade or the pair of nylons. Modern industry saves us endless labor and drudgery, but Janice faced it also bars us from taking part in the forming of material and leaves idle our sense of touch, and with it, those formative faculties that are stimulated by it. We touch things to assure ourselves of reality. We touch the objects of our love. We touch the things we form. Our tactile experiences are elemental.
Well, before we jump into what we think about Annie Albers, I wanted to feature what some of our listeners said when we asked them what this quote meant to them. Let's start with Alexandra Matz, a design student at the Royal College of Art in London.
We certainly have grown increasingly insensitive in our perception by touch, the tactile sense. Isn't it so interesting how Annie Albers highlights what already was visible in the years when she wrote her book, but sadly became even more very up-to-date in the recent 18 months of the pandemic in which we could not always touch in the way we were used to or to hug people we are close to. And while we saw a small trend that we baked bread ourselves at home or that we grew herbs in our kitchen windows exactly due to the pandemic, Albers highlights how the convenience factor, as we might call it today, has entered our lives, be it in home delivery services or buying mass-produced clothes that are sometimes cheaper than a quality ball of yarn. It is so interesting that the textile artist Richard Tuttle, who often refers to Annie Albers in his writings, Tuttle talks about textiles in terms of love and quotes him, "When we wear clothes, we are literally surrounded by love. First there's love, then there's fabric." So a really interesting connection between the two acclaimed artists, as I find.
I love that. First there's love, and then there's fabric. Next is Jessica Uano, a Filipina artist and founder of Damgo Studio.
I have worked in fast fashion and eventually transitioned to working for a social enterprise that preserves Philippine handloom weaving culture and supports livelihood through contemporary and circular design. My journey as a designer has made me very aware of the disconnect between materials, the people who make our products, and the end product itself. This passage is something I can relate to as a designer and handloom weaver because of the challenges I have experienced while trying to research and connect with manufacturers to understand the journey of the materials that I use. In my experience, it hasn't been straightforward to get information about which farm my yarn's fiber comes from, for example. This has something to do with the complexities of our global supply chains, that involve many different stakeholders. As Annie Albers has mentioned, modern industry saves us from endless labor and drudgery, but it also bars us from taking part in the forming of material. Advancement, despite its benefits, have made it difficult for the everyday consumer, or even a designer like myself, to build a connection and appreciation for the materials in our products. In my experience, I have felt a different sense of satisfaction, appreciation, and connection to the textiles and products I make when I'm able to truly understand where it came from and how it got to me, especially if I'm able to visit a farm where the fiber is sourced and participate in its transformation. But I am one of the lucky few who has had the privilege to take the time to understand my product's journey. I feel that the lack of appreciation for a product resulting in our wasteful consumer culture comes from a limited understanding of everything that goes into getting this product into a consumer's hands. This has led me to question, how can industry bridge the gap and help designers and consumers rebuild this connection and appreciation for materials? And could this possibly be one solution to the sustainability challenges we are facing today?
That sounds like exactly what we want to talk about. Thanks so much, Jessica. So Rachel, now it's your turn. Why was this quote so meaningful to you?
I think as a weaver, let me back up. I think as just a consumer in general, it's really important to understand where your objects and materials and the things that you're spending your money on come from. And then I think that's especially important as a weaver to understand where the yarn that you're weaving with, the materials that you're purchasing, the fiber that you're using, where it comes from. And I think so often we do not have this relationship. I mean, this is a huge problem also with the food industry that, you know, we don't have a relationship with the food that we're eating. And therefore, we don't necessarily know how to make healthy choices sometimes, or we don't know that we might be buying into a system that's really harmful to other individuals. And I think the same thing happens with fiber and with yarn, where we don't necessarily understand where material comes from. And then it loses its inherent value in a way, because there isn't an understanding of the time, the energy, the money, the process, the human, all of those things. We merely toast the bread, as Annie Albers says, like we have no idea how the bread is made. We just toast it. And I think that removes us from having a responsibility to purchase consciously and to invest in higher quality materials that are less harmful. And it allows us to access things without any sort of responsibility to anyone else outside of our own studios, or our own practices, or our own homes.
Yeah. With clothing, this is like especially true, like that you can get a shirt for, you know, $6 and then, yes, you know, if you don't like it, or if you want another one, it's easy enough to get another one. It's easy enough to throw the last thing away. And Yeah, you just cycle through clothing and things you own really quickly. And I think having a relationship to even at any part of the textile industry, you start to see like, no, this is a lot of work, and it's worth way more than that $6 you spend on a top.
Right. And then you look at something like linen tends to be a really expensive yarn. When you're purchasing linen tends to be a higher end price point. It's something that compared to like wool or cotton, depending, I mean, hand spun wool that's locally farmed can also be pretty expensive, and there's a reason why. But with linen, I think a lot of people feel like it's out of their price range. And then I recently took a flax to linen workshop in Vermont at the Marshfield School of Weaving, and I learned the process of breaking flax. And there's this crazy step process to get flax turned into linen. And then to know that now the linen that I have that I spun myself is like the most precious commodity ever, because yeah, it took me days to make one little skein of linen. And then to think about that these processes, even with flax production that are maybe done at a larger scale and maybe are done in factories, that there's still a huge process from taking the plant and turning it into yarn. And to have a better understanding of that adds inherent value. You can understand where it's coming from, and you can understand why it's valuable and why you might want to invest in it.
Yeah, no, tell me more about that. What was it like for you to get your own materials and make a fiber from scratch?
I mean, it was mind-blowing. Essentially, what happens, like a very quick overview of flax to linen, is you have to get the seeds, which either you can buy seeds or you can save seeds from your last harvest. You have to plant them and grow them and water them and cultivate them. And then when they're at a certain height, then you need to pull them. You literally pull the entire flax plant out of the ground, roots and all. And then you need to red it, which is essentially rotting it, which can take days to weeks. And then after that, you have to dry it out. Then you have to actually break the flax. So you use something called a flax break, and then you scutch it, and then you heckle it. These are all like getting the fibers loose. And then lastly, after that, then you actually have to spin it. So then it becomes either tow or line. They're two different qualities of flax. And then you have to spin it either on a hand spindle or on a flax spinning wheel before it turns into yarn. And then there's even a finishing process after that to even get it into a workable warp yarn or weft yarn. So it's like a multi-day process even after the flax is harvested, all to get a pretty small amount of yarn. Like in our workshop, we joked, we were all like, oh, we can grow our own little flax patch and make a tunic. And then the more and more we learned about the process, we were like, okay, actually it's going to be a crop top. Like, because by the time you go through all of those steps, it's just so much work to get such a small amount of yarn. And it makes you really, really appreciate how linen is made and how it's been made for centuries.
Yeah. I think really getting back to kind of like the ancient wisdom kind of things about this is like the techniques that we've developed and the techniques that stay are normally ones that have stayed for a reason, that they're really good techniques and that they've been tried by time. And that also like the experts who are making those things really know what they're doing too.
Mm-hmm.
But just the question of like, are we valuing these experts and are we valuing these materials to the degree that they should be valued? I've been thinking about how much like the kind of mundane routines of life have come to mean to me, like during this like COVID season, and how much more mindfully enjoying those things. So thinking about, yeah, like making your own bread or like appreciating things that you can make yourself and do yourself. That's really meaningful because I think in a world where like so much of the actual needs of our lives are like outsourced to other people, it's really liberating and really it's nice. It slows down life. It really like makes you appreciate things more when you can do some of these things yourself.
Yeah, that's very true. Is there like one routine or maybe like quote unquote mundane thing that you've like really enjoyed during quarantine or during the pandemic?
Yeah. I mean, I've really loved baking. While we were on break from the podcast, we also moved to Baltimore City. So
is you and your husband, Jonathan, who is my brother.
Yeah. So Jonathan and I and our son, we moved to Baltimore and we go to the farmer's market just about every week. And I love finding like local produce or local dairy and being able to make something with it. And that's really cool to me to know that I know the people who grew this. Back in early pandemic, I had went to the farmer's market in our old town and gotten yarn from like a local vendor where I was like, okay, well now I want to buy something. Like I want to weave something really special with this yarn because I know who spun it. You know, it really changes to have a relationship to the goods that you use in everyday life.
And I'm sure, right, there's like an intentionality. Not only do you want to make something special with it, but you're going to be really intentional about how you use it because it is a precious commodity.
Yeah. Yeah. We made
why are you laughing?
Plum tarts. I made these plum tarts over the weekend and I didn't have a plan for anyone to share it with. And I feel so stupid eating these plum tarts by myself.
No, don't feel stupid.
No, but what I'm trying to say is like, it also means that like, the purpose for these things that I make like is really important to me now. Like I wouldn't weave just anything with that yarn. I wouldn't make just anything with like the fruit. I it's like a community thing, right? Like you get your raw materials from the community and what you create is given back to the community. That's kind of like what I've been thinking about as I take on some of these practices.
And how cool would it be to trade your plum tarts for some yarn?
Yes, exactly.
I think ultimately when I think about community and how I would want to build community at Weaver House, like around this idea, is in my mind kind of cutting out valuing anything like monetarily. And I know that's like not easy all the time, but that everyone is making something and sourcing something intentionally, and that the value is the gift that you're giving it to another community member, or that you're receiving, and that there's this give and receive, and nothing necessarily has to do with money. And it's more just about, you know, you're making plum tarts from the farm down the road, and someone else is, you know, carting their wool, and they get a dessert and you get a new weaving piece, and then you're going to make that weaving and give it to someone else who need, I don't know. There's just this idea of this continual. And I think when we were writing about material culture in the beginning, the line that I really love that I pulled from Annie Albers, this overarching theme, is that we're all connected by this material language of touch, which is a tactile sensibility, which is directly from Annie Albers. And that material language of touch is so beautiful in thinking about that we are all connected that way. And like, what if our community looked like that? And I know I'm kind of like skipping around here a little bit, but I think it all comes back to that text of like, if we had an awareness of the objects that we were using, and if we had more of a holistic view of the things that we were making and the materials we were handling, I think that we would treat each other differently as well. Like, I think that would affect the community in a really beautiful way.
Yeah. Well, because so much of this distance that we've created from the materials and the processes and the people, it just results in this lack of relationship. And I think in order to know what communities need and what communities are hurting, there has to be some kind of relationship there to know the needs of a community. And that's why it gets so, it feels so gross when people's like goods are taken advantage of, not only because, you know, that's monetary loss, that's mm-hmm. a business that's going away, but also because it breaks this relationship and we're profiting off of people who have gifted us their cultures and gifted us their practices while, you know, and we can allow them to suffer because we're not even aware of it because there's no relationship there. I think so much about like Navajo practices that have been lifted and just taken and just used and mass produced, whereas there's so many problems that face the Native American community that then these people who are profiting off their culture aren't giving back into fixing some of those problems and being a part of solutions and, I don't know, just kind of giving credit where credit is due.
Because you haven't read Braiding Sweetgrass yet, right?
No, you've talked about it though.
This book has brought out every emotion in me. Like the pages, I've cried, I've laughed, I've literally underlined half the book. Even if you ask me right now to like read a passage, I don't know how I would choose. Like you just have to, it's like the whole thing. I just looked it up. It's Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teaching of Plants by Robin Wall Kimmerer. She has roots within Native American culture. She is Native American, but she's also a scientist, and she kind of like marries the two ideas. And she talks so much about reciprocity and like also so much about gift giving, and the whole book is just so beautifully written. But I think it's also exactly what you're talking about and how Indigenous cultures have such a deep connection to the land and never take more than they need. And they practice gratitude above all else. There's actually this one chapter that's called, I think, Allegiance to Gratitude. And like, it talks about specifically how like we pledge allegiance to the United States and like Indigenous cultures pledge allegiance to the earth and to being grateful for what they have. And just the disconnect there is crazy to think about.
Yeah, no, I mean, thinking about having a relationship with the land, any person that you're in serious relationship with, you're going to look for their long-term good. So like if you had relationship with the land and if you had relationship with the people around you, you wouldn't let the land be desecrated. You wouldn't let the land be destroyed, and you wouldn't let the people around you go hungry or have, you would want other people to have what you have. So keeping that in mind when thinking about how we think about money and how we think about community, I think that's a really good thing to kind of frame what we're talking about. Because like you said, yeah, it would be great to kind of think about running a business or living a lifestyle that isn't so centered around money. And where that's not always like realistic, I think thinking about how we think about money in our practices is really good.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's something I wrestle with all the time, because running a business is about making money. Like, it's really hard to not center that, because it's really easy to go out of business if you're not, you know, money savvy, or if you're not saving, or if you're not investing well. And so you need to care about money in order to run a healthy business that is going to be sustainable. But I also just, I don't care about making money in the sense of like, I will make money to sustain this business so that I can be a resource for the community. But I wish I could give stuff away, or I wish I could feel good about giving stuff away too. Like, I wish it could be that there was more of this holistic practice. Cause I think the other thing that happens when everything is so centered around money is sometimes it's really hard to give, because people just take and they take and they take and they take without giving in return. Like, they don't see it as giving and receiving. Mm-hmm. So like, often I feel like my position, you know, here with Weaver House, like sometimes I get really exhausted because I feel like I am giving so much right now, and I'm not really getting anything in return. And I don't really think, I think because it's like a business that like customers and students don't often think about like how they can necessarily like give back to Weaver House. And in some ways I know that they are purchasing from me, so they are giving me money, but that's where I'm like, I don't, like, I know I need that in order to sustain the business, but what else could there be an exchange of, maybe, is what I'm trying to problem solve. And I still don't have an answer. And maybe that was also kind of abstract, but I'm constantly thinking about that because I want to be able to give, but we're not like set up to do that as a society. Well, I feel like, at least.
Yeah. The underlying question of all of this is just like, what if I ran out, right? Like, what if I give and then I have nothing left? Is that kind of what you feel like runs some
of the- Well, because I feel like I often feel that way. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel often if I'm giving that, then people like take advantage. This is also something that Robin Wall Kimmerer talks about, but she talks about that, like, she has this vision of being at a farmer's market where if everything was free at the farmer's market, like, she would walk up to a table and she would say, you know, I need this. And that the person behind the table would say, please, it's my gift to you. And that instead of taking five, she would take one because she only needed one. Mm-hmm. But if it was something that like, it was a dollar for five, like, she would buy all five and take them all home, but she really only needs one. And how this idea that if things were free, that people would only, or this like holistic idea that you would only take what you needed because you would leave something for someone else. And when there's a monetary value attached to it, like, she was saying, like, I would leave the farmer's market with just enough in my basket for what my household needs. But I often currently leave the farmer's market like with my basket overflowing.
Is it because you're afraid of running out? Is what it is?
Yeah, I think so. And that's, I kind of feel that way when I often release something, even if I release like a downloadable weaving pattern for free. And I often feel like there are people that will download every single one of my free patterns without ever buying one of the non-free ones. And sometimes I'm like, maybe genuinely you just only like the free ones and that's okay. But I think when you see that happen as a pattern over and over again, sometimes I am like, maybe it should be like, I will download one free pattern and I will weave that pattern. And when I'm done weaving it, then I'll download another pattern. And maybe that time it won't be a free one. Like, I don't know, just this idea of not like, just because it's free, you need to consume all everything that's free. I don't, does that make any sense?
It makes sense. Or... I think it gets hairier with like intellectual property like that. I think it really feels like the illustration of food is really good because that's something that can go to waste, right?
Yeah, that's true. I think
the same thing applies though. And I think at the base of this is seeing someone else's labor as valuable.
Yeah.
Is what's at the root of this. Because if you were to take a whole, think of like the term, if you were to get like a whole thing of fruit at the farmer's market when you really just want one piece of fruit, you can see that food go to waste in your
fridge. That's true.
And then nobody else can use it. There's a similar thing to that though, in that if you see food go to waste, you could think about like, okay, well, there was a farmer who made that food and like all these people who were involved in getting this food to me and all these other people that it could have fed. I think in the same way, arts, if you were compensated fairly, and if anybody who's making art was compensated fairly, they would have more to give elsewhere. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's valuing someone's time. And it's, you know, the customer who asks me, you know, writes me an email and asks me all these questions, and I help answer all of these questions for them. And then they respond to the email and they're like, oh, thank you for all of that information. I'm going to buy the loom at this store because it's free shipping. And it's like, I just spent half an hour writing this email out for you and helping you choose a loom. And then you're directly telling me that you're going to buy it elsewhere. Like, okay.
Yeah.
But that's where I wish that it was like, I don't necessarily like see receiving as monetary. I think that's what I'm trying to problem solve is like, what do I actually want in return?
Well, it's a relationship too. Like you have a relationship with your customers. And I think social media makes that all very confusing because everyone becomes a potential customer who like you sort of have relationship, but sort of don't. Like the relationship is based on whenever each of you chooses to be in it. But mostly the customer has more control here, right? That they can turn away from you at any point, that they can take what they want and that they don't have to give anything in return unless they want to. So I think to exist on social media, you have to be creating some kind of content that's free and that can be easily taken advantage of too. That there's a lot of people giving out free weaving things online and you can gain a lot of knowledge that took a lot of labor from different people across the internet, but you could get all that for free. And then you might not need to like take a weaving class or even like download a pattern because you've taken that, but there was no relationship involved in that. And I think that's where it gets to be hard is like, I don't think the casual consumer thinks about that. I don't think that I would have thought about that before having a relationship with you and knowing like I put a lot of work into this and a lot of people never end up buying anything at all.
I guess I think you just figured out what the root of it is. And I think it is that lack of relationship, of feeling like I'm catering to a lot of people that I don't have a meaningful relationship with. So how can that give and take really happen, right? If you're not like invested in each other. Maybe that's just part of me just like coming to terms with being a business owner, because maybe that's just the reality of owning a business. And maybe that's just something I haven't gotten used to or comfortable with. But I think I'm really trying to figure out how to have boundaries in a meaningful way and how to ask people to respect them. A lot of it like holistically comes back to this relationship that we have to communities, to materials. Like to me, that's not a jump. Appreciating your materials is also like appreciating the person who is sourcing them for you and appreciating even before that, the person who made them and the whole line of that. And I think there's something that Amazon has just like brainwashed us into believing that everything is accessible and instant. And if we don't get it exactly our way and on time and in 3 days, like it's not good enough.
Yeah. I mean, it's just thinking about how long the world operated without the level of internationalness and instant gratification and just all the things that we're able to do now. There's so many great benefits to that. But I think what we lose is really being able to put a face to the people who make our day-to-day life possible. Mm-hmm. Like if this were, you know, 200 years ago, you would be like the local yarn person in town and you would be like, you'd be serving your immediate town, right? And everyone would know you. And, you know, if you were really slow one month because of something going on in your personal life, people would know that, right? Like
yep.
If you were struggling to make ends meet because of a lack of business, like people would know that. It's just like, you don't know what's going on with people. And social media gives you this illusion of knowing that when it's not true. Yeah, I think it's all about relationships and community and knowing that our society doesn't work like that anymore, but knowing like, how can we be aware of that and adapt is really important because I think it does have a lot to do with boundaries and knowing what you want to give away for free. That changes things when you know that it might not be received in relationship in the way that you want it to be, but also then thinking about like, okay, the ways that we consume things, how can we be more mindful and like be that kind of change that we want to see? Cause I think, I don't know, I follow a lot of pages on Instagram that are like purely educational, like whether that's around social justice, whether that's around like historical kind of things, they're giving out essentially everything for free and are just relying on people being like, hey, this is valuable enough to give money to through like
I'll donate to you.
Yeah, I'll donate to you or I will buy your paid content, even though I get a lot of information for free because to create daily content, there's so much stuff that goes out. So I don't know. I think sometimes for me, that means I'm not going to follow as many pages, but the ones that I do follow, I'm going to really invest in. And like making that choice because we can't all support every small business out there, but we can find the ones that are really valuable to us and try and cultivate a better relationship there.
I think that's where I even feel like I contradict myself a bit in my own mind. But I think if I'm like listening, if I am really like deep down, like in my gut, like, why does this feel really bad to me if someone does something like that? Like if they download a free weaving pattern, but they've never purchased something from a shop and they never like patronize my business. Like, why does that feel so bad? Because I have put it out for free. Like they're not doing anything wrong by downloading it. Like I made it free. And I do think what I have come to realize is that I think what I often see too, which is all like ads on top of that, is then like people will weave that pattern and not like tag me or credit me. Or I've even seen people like selling things with one of these free patterns that I've designed. And that to me just feels like, okay, we are really missing something here. If you think it's okay to download a pattern for free and then monetize it and never credit or patronize me, like how have we become this disconnected? Like how is our relationship this broken? And credit and monetizing wouldn't matter if there was this true give and take, right? Like that's where a lot of that feels so gross because it just feels like a lot of taking without, you know, giving in return. And I like the idea of people downloading a pattern and repurposing their yarn and their stash to weave the pattern. And that's why it's really not about like purchasing something from my shop, because I also think that's more sustainable. And if you can do that, that's great. But that there's like something, I don't know. I don't know what this solution is.
I think it is. Like, I think back to the example of like, if you're running a little yarn shop and
if I had a yarn wagon.
Well, no, I mean, I'm saying like, okay, so say, you know, little Timmy is in town and you know that he can't afford yarn. It's not about how much people spend at your store.
Right.
It's about relationship. So you might give that to little Timmy, but if it's outside of the context of relationship, it doesn't make any sense. Right. Like I think the crediting or even like, I don't know if it would feel different to you if the people who are downloading, if you were like, oh, I know them, they interact with my content all the time. And then they tagged me in it afterwards. And I know that, you know, like, I think this feeling of, I know you and I'm looking out for your good is what drives like all of this. It feels like you're being taken advantage of when someone uses your gifts or what you've created and isn't actually looking out for your good.
I feel like so many customers that have come into the shop that like will come into the shop and pick something up. Maybe it's like a yarn that I have in the studio that's not actually for sale or something. And they're just like, this is the most beautiful yarn I've ever seen. And I often will be like, oh, really? Like you should take it and make something with it then. Like I'm not currently using it. Like you should have it. And every single time I feel like people are like shocked by that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that, but that is like ultimately the goal for me, right? And like the same thing, I feel like I have been able to foster relationships where someone, a customer will come in and say like, I found this really cool fiber. I got some for you. Maybe you might want to source it. Or maybe you, I feel like you could weave something really beautiful with it. And the same way there's like, there is, it's about relationship. There's this relationship or even, you know, knowing there's a handful of people in Philly that are constantly telling people about my shop. And I come in, you know, people will call me up and be like, so-and-so like told me to come take a class with you. Like, I know nothing about weaving. And I'm just like, these people are like tooting my horn, like everywhere they go. Mm-hmm. And that makes me feel like so valued and taken care of. And like, I also want to give to them. And I don't really think it's like, needs to be equal. And I don't think it needs to be measured, but I do think that those are the relationships that I really want to foster. And like, I think those, like knowing people deeply and the people that are making what you're buying, the people that are growing what you're buying, the community that is part of that, like that is really the only way that we are really going to solve this problem or be able to create more of a conscious living society.
I think that any change that's not rooted in relationship doesn't really last. Like when we think about the changes that so many people have made over the past year, to be thinking about other people, like I think that all of that starts to feel really hollow when you're just judging it off of like random people on the internet. Like, is my activism enough? Is my lifestyle enough? Like, is it actually making a difference? Like, I think outside of relationship, all of that feels really hollow because then why are you doing any of this? Why are you like shopping ethically is really, really hard and really expensive.
Yeah.
And it feels so, I don't know. It just feels like it would be so much easier to do things a different way. Like that you would get all your packages faster and you'd be able to consume more and nobody else is thinking about this. So why should I? And I think it's really easy to get disconnected from the people that actually affects and the impact, the small impact like that our actions can have. But in a community, that's so much easier to see.
Yeah, it really is. And it's also like, I feel like in a community, it's easier to say, I have an abundance of this and you have an abundance of this. Let's share that with each other. Or maybe I ran out of this. Do you have any of that? And next time you have extra. And I just feel that way with yarn, with creating, with art making, with fiber weaving, all of that. Like I've been thinking for a long time about how to share more of that. All of my solutions are also like anti-business. So I don't know how to land on that, or maybe not anti-business, but anti-consumerism, right? I'm like, we all just need to stop buying stuff and use what we have and repurpose what we have and try, you know, the most sustainable option is less, consuming less is actually buying less. Even if you're buying a yarn that's like organic, it's still postage, pollution, like everything involved with even getting that shipped to you, right? So in that terms of like, I've been thinking, okay, how do I implement like a de-stashing program, you know, where people once a year go through all of the yarn that they've been hoarding, because that's what I do. I like hoard yarn for years and years. I'm like, one day I'm going to weave something with this. And you know, that rarely happens. You just buy more new yarn. And like, how do we share with each other what we have and how do we like hold on to less, but always know that we're going to have what we need because we're all sharing with each other. And that it's not about hoarding. It's more about because giving, you know, you're going to be receiving. And that's, I don't know how to make that work. And I don't know how that works in terms of a business model, because if everyone stops buying yarn, I'll be out of business. But that is, I've been thinking about that a lot.
But yeah, I think part of that is you are giving to the community. Like, say you were to do something like that, it's in the hopes that then that community is more invested in relationship with you. And
that's true.
Make sure that you don't go out of business from having a yarn share. You know,
like, I don't know. I could do.
Well, I think, yeah, relationships require trust, and that, like, any generosity is also an act of trust. I don't know. I guess if you're being generous enough for it to be costly, that has to, like, require some amount of trust that other people would give similarly to you if you were in a different situation.
Well, I think even though I have been thinking about these themes for a really long time and wrestling with them, there's always room to grow and to learn. And I feel like even recently I have had a few realizations that I was like, oh, this is, like, right in front of my face and I couldn't see it. And I want to mention that also because I think people might be, like, listening to this, looking around at their yarn stash, and I'm not trying to, like, give anyone an immense guilt trip or anything.
Yeah.
Or thinking, like, you know, I don't appreciate them patronizing my business. But someone came into my soft opening this weekend and they were like, they said to me, I'm really trying to reduce my supply chain to, you know, purchase things that are local, that are within my area, within a certain radius, cut back on shipping and all of that. Do you, like, what yarns in your shop are locally produced? Mm-hmm. And I was like, none. I work with one mill that's here in Philadelphia, but the fiber that they're sourcing is not from Philadelphia. It's imported. So one step of the process is kind of local, but it's not, the whole supply chain is not local. And I don't source any, like, hand spun wool from local farmers or herders, or I don't really do that. And I've never done that. And I don't know why. It's just something that I never really thought through. Like, this is an opportunity for me to support small farms, and I'm going to start doing that, or I'm going to make that a part of my business plan within the next year to try to start to do that. And it's going to be a lot harder than being able to go on, like, a wholesale portal and just place an order with a big yarn company and have it shipped to me. But I think that's really important. And I'm kind of shocked that I never thought about it before.
Yeah, no, I think that's awesome. And I think that, like, kind of being open to areas that you can always grow in, that kind of thing, is so great. Because, yeah, when you look at shopping ethically, or just, yeah, generosity, any kind of, like, thing like this, it just seems so massive at first. And you take it,
yeah,
step by step, and there's always more to grow in. But every step is also, like, worth celebrating. And that's a new relationship that you have there that hopefully there will be a lot of fruit from. That's really cool. I think also, yeah, like, the relationship in itself is valuable too, right? Like, that we're all, it's not just about taking and giving, but it's about being connected to each other. And the way that we experience life when we're connected to each other is so much richer. I think this culture of, like, consumerism and also, like, just rugged individualism, it like is very costly, even for people who are outwardly really successful, because at the end of the day, those relationships aren't there where they're caring about other people as much as they care about themselves.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about, like, what is the true cost? Like, in the first episode that we recorded together, we were talking about when things are made in sweatshops where their working or labor conditions are not regulated and are not safe, and you are purchasing that $6 t-shirt from Target, like, what is the true cost? And I think that you can ask that about anything, right? Like, anything that you're consuming or anything you're supporting, like, what is the true cost here? And am I willing to take responsibility for it? Because by purchasing that shirt or by involving yourself in those systems, you are becoming part of the problem. And, like, you and I still, like, we are not innocent in this. Like, it's the same thing. We're not growing everything in our backyard and we're not weaving all of our own clothes. And I mean, I think we try to make sustainable choices. We try to purchase from small, you know, businesses, and we try to support, like, small clothing companies and things like that. But like you said, it's really hard to do that. It is. Yeah. And you have to have money to a certain extent to be able to do that because those things are more expensive. And I can't also imagine adding kids into the mix of that, you know, and all kids are growing and you're constantly changing their clothes. And there's so many layers there that like, you know, there's absolutely no judgment. I just think it is also like something that is important.
I don't know. I think we said this in our first episode that we did together too, is that like, sometimes you can come out of these conversations around doing the right thing, around justice, around sustainability. And it feels all really negative and it feels all like,
I know,
shamey very quickly. But when I read that passage from Annie Albers, it's a very beautiful kind of invitation to be a part of like making the dough, to be a part of like all of these greater processes that allow us to live our lives. And I think that doesn't have to be any one way of doing things. When you mentioned kids, I was thinking about like, Rachel's mom, my mother-in-law, like she just goes to like flea markets all the time. And that's like the way that she like likes to provide for my son. And I don't know. I think it's funny.
Because every like, toy ever.
Well, so much of the stuff me or Rachel look at and we're like, that is the ugliest thing I've ever seen.
So ugly. Like, but, why would she buy that?
But maybe the cost is not having like the cutest clothes for Judah all the time, right?
Yeah.
Like, not needing my preferences to come first and instead like being okay with, you know, thrifted things. And sometimes there's really cute thrifted things too. So, but
yeah,
like, I think there are small steps and, I don't know, knowing that it will cost something makes it easier to like decide what cost you're willing to pay. Like right now I'm like too into social media. I'm too into like watching like people's like hauls from like shopping things and I want everything, but I'm still like feeling this tension around like, I don't want to buy too much. So then when I do buy something new, I think I'm thinking a lot more about like, is this something that I'll actually wear? Is this something that I actually like? And just being able to be happy with the things that you already have and appreciate those, I think is a big step in this too.
Yeah. Because that's where I fall into that too. Like, I think I hadn't bought anything new, like in terms of clothing in a while throughout the whole pandemic. And then what are we getting dressed up for? Like, where are we going? Right. Yeah. And we just had this, I remember there was like a few months in the pandemic where I had like five things that I was just wearing on rotation, which were just comfy clothes to weave in. Mm-hmm. And then when I was thinking about reopening the shop, there was like a few days where I was like, okay, well, I need cute new stuff now because like, I'm going to be seeing people in person again. And I made a purchase and it all arrived and I looked at it and I said, I don't need any of this. Why did I buy this?
Yeah.
Like it was that knee jerk reaction though, of like, I need something new. And it's because I'm fed with Instagram ads constantly of these really cute things. Like they know what I want.
Yeah.
And then I fall into that rabbit hole of like, oh, that's really adorable. And I returned it all. And then I felt, you know, I felt good about returning it, but I felt silly for falling into that trap initially.
Yeah.
And I think it's just really hard. It is hard with social media when you're fed, like that advertising is designed to get you to consume more. And so it is a battle. I mean, you're constantly, you know, barraged with like how to consume. So it is kind of a battle to recenter and think, yeah, what is more important? And I think there's people, what's become really cool to see is a lot of people too have made mending really popular and like repurposing really popular and written books on it and done tutorials on it. And like, how do you make something last for more than one cycle? You know, if it has a hole in it, how do you repair it and do it in a really cool way so that it's almost like trendy in a way, like to have things that are mended. And I think that's really cool to see, because that is another thing that is important to think about. Like if something gets a tear or a hole in it, that it doesn't immediately hit the garbage can, that it has more life to live.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool to think about like our garments, like having stories and having a longer life cycle than we might normally see in a school.
Well, and also if we had to grow the flax, go through the whole process to spin it and then weave it and then sew it, and then had this tunic that we made out of flax, like if it got a hole in it, there's no way in hell you'd be throwing that out. just wouldn't happen. Like that value, that's what we're missing, right? So like if you were making that all yourself, like you would mend that thing until it was a whole new textile.
Yeah.
And it to think about it, like you said, in a really poetic way, it's also really beautiful to think about that it holds those stories, that it holds touch, that it is, you know, cloth is a mark of the human hand and it records our whole lives because it's inherently part of our lives. So that is really beautiful to think about as well.
Yeah. And I'm so excited to kind of like start, I don't want to say start again, because I think our first season of the podcast was really great and I really loved it. But to think about uncovering more of these stories and like thinking about our relationship to materials and our relationship to manufacturing and all these different processes. I'm excited to take that as a journey together with the listeners of this podcast, to have more community input in future episodes, and just, to keep growing our relationship to each other and our relationship to materials.
Yeah, same. Those are my favorite DMs. When I get a DM from someone that is like, you talked about this thing on the pod and this is my thought, or I hadn't thought about it that way, or have you thought about this, like almost challenging, you know, our mindset too, which I think those are the conversations that I really, I thirst for. Like I want to be in conversation with people, and that's also building community. That's building a stronger community. And so I think I'm very excited to be able to do that.
I think this would actually be a great place to end on a submission from Kate Kilmurray, who's a weaver and teacher from Ojai, California.
Albers knows that when we work with our hands, there's a deepening connection with ourselves that naturally translates to a deepening connection with others. Participating in the process of making is a way of being connected to life itself. Our souls are joyful in this connection. We gain meaning, purpose, and a sense in being alive. Making is a fully embodied expression of the heart.
One of the reasons I've loved being a part of this podcast, as someone who's not necessarily a fiber artist, is that creating art is about so much more than the art itself. It's about finding beauty and meaning and connection. And for those of us making a living this way, it's about trusting a community to value your work and your time when so much of the world doesn't. It's very brave to trust in a community this way. Creating is vulnerable. Generosity is vulnerable. But it allows us to connect in the ways that we were designed to. While the pandemic has disrupted so many of our routines, I think it's also reminded us of what's really important. And that's our relationship to each other, to our world, and to ourselves. I'm excited to begin forming a more active community around the podcast and want to give a huge thank you to those of you who submitted voice memos. We weren't able to include all of them, but there were so many beautiful thoughts that we definitely want to be using some in later episodes. We also want to put out our next call for submissions, which will be in connection to a project we're doing with Portland Textile Month, which you can find linked in the show notes. There will be lots of events and great artists featured online and in person for Portland Textile Month, so definitely check them out. But for our event, we're asking the question, how have you incorporated new traditions into your weaving practice as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and other world events this past year? You can record a brief message via voice memo and send it to us at media@weaverhouseco.com. A huge thank you goes out to Rachel E. Snack for our conversation this month, as well as Weaver House for being an episode sponsor. Thanks also to Philadelphia-based musician Michael Myers for the use of his song, Weave, off the album, There Is Only Light. We are currently publishing episodes of Material Culture Monthly with some extra events for Portland Textile Month in October. If you love the podcast, we would so appreciate you leaving a rating on Apple Podcasts. And if you have comments or questions for us, please email us at our address linked in the show notes. Thanks so much for joining us, And until next time, let's keep learning about what it means to create with each other in mind.